Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. So this morning, we are going to be presenting a special report that's entitled Loneliness and Making Connections. Since the COVID era, we've been hearing so much about the epidemic of loneliness and social isolation. And I was so thrilled when one of our new partners at the Connecticut Psychological Association, CPA, Dr. Kathleen Chapman, reached out in the hopes of bringing our program a conversation on this subject. And I felt it was so important that we would not only feature this conversation with Kathy, but also engage a conversation with an organization we've talked a lot about on the program, Thin Line Peer Support, as well as bringing in some perspective from U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, who so far on Capitol Hill in Washington has introduced two important pieces of legislation dealing with loneliness and social isolation, and who's been a real authority and an advocate to address these situations, the stigmas that they cause, and the negative outcomes that it's having, especially with some of our youngest folks here in Connecticut and around the country. So we'll bring you all of those conversations in this special report, and we'll start it off with our conversation with Dr. Chapman right after we invite you to a fun and creative evening of painting, charcuterie boards, drinking wine, and enjoying snacks to benefit Ruth's House, a recent guest here on For the People. This paint and sip event is a wonderful opportunity to nurture your creativity while making a real difference in the lives of single mothers. Every registration helps provide the supportive, empowering environment they need to build brighter futures for themselves and their children. The gathering and step-by-step painting class is happening on Friday, October 25th. You can get details on the Ruth's House website. And if you can't make it to the event, you can still support their mission by making a donation. It's all available for you, along with ways to get your tickets to this event at ruthshousect.com. So, Kathy, that sounds like a great way to get a little bit more social, doesn't it?
Oh, it absolutely does. That's exactly some of the things that we'll be talking about.
That's great. Well, for folks who may not be aware, the Connecticut Psychological Association has been a incredible resource to us here on For the People and to our listeners over the past 4 or 5 years. And I'm so pleased, Kathy, to bring your voice back onto the program here. Kathy's a clinical psychologist in private practice, and she's chair of the CPA Public Education Committee. So this is a great fit. She's also a member of the Connecticut Suicide Advisory Board. And for the past 10 years, she's been involved in public education and awareness on mental health topics like resiliency, suicide prevention, and she strongly believes in the importance of using the science of psychology to support social connections and well-being for everyone. So, Kathy, beyond that introduction, just give people a little bit more insight into what CPA is all about.
Well, the Connecticut Psychological Association is dedicated, it's a professional organization dedicated to advancing psychology and psychological science, and supporting psychologists to inform the public policy and legislation, as well as to work with the community. It's a way that we can keep the community up to date on psychological science to support people's mental health, physical health, and their well-being.
Now, you guys work not only in direct relationship with your clients and patients, but you're also very much engaged at the State House on issues of interest to your members.
Yes, we definitely have all kinds of education programs going on, as well as efforts to promote the practice of psychology in Connecticut and nationally.
And equity, diversity, and inclusion are also a major part of the framework of CPA.
It is a very important part. Most members of CPA really support including all members of the community, as well as we have a wide range of representation around the whole diverse network of psychologists.
Great. And I ask this question of whoever is on the program from your organization, because in conversation with people out in the world, I often hear confusion between what a psychologist does and the services and supports you deliver to your clients and psychiatrists and what they do for their patients.
Sure. Psychologists are the only doctoral level mental health providers who specialize in mental health disorders assessment. Psychologists are able to provide thorough assessments to determine diagnosis and to inform treatment planning. They also develop specialized programs for behavioral issues such as behavioral treatment and as well as psychotherapy. For psychiatry training, of course, is based on a strong medical foundation. They do prescribe medication, but they may also provide therapy as well. So there is some overlap.
Very good. So moving into the subject matter, I mean, you wouldn't have a passionate lawmaker like U.S. Senator Chris Murphy introducing not one but two pieces of legislation last year in regards to loneliness and social isolation and beginning to address this epidemic here in Connecticut and across the country, but stepping up in quick succession, our Surgeon General declaring social isolation as a legitimate national health emergency. You are, and your colleagues who are addressing this matter, are in the right place at the right time. Let's talk a little bit on the strong background of research in regards to social connections, isolations, and the fallout that can result if individuals don't have and enjoy regular social contact and interactions.
Yes, absolutely. Since 2003, as the Surgeon General's report outlines, there's been an increase of Americans reporting that they are experiencing feelings of loneliness each year. That's increasing. And we know there's a strong background of research on how important social connections are for our physical health, for our mental health, for just our sense of being able to cope with life and have a happier life. Would be helpful to start off with a definition of what social connection actually is. And basically, social connection is your personal experience of feeling a sense of belonging with others, feeling that you're cared for, that you're close to others, and that you're valued and loved. These are very important experiences which humans, by our nature, we are social creatures. We adapt to life by working with others, connecting with others.
You often hear of the negative outcomes when people are either stigmatized or identified as having kind of been, you know, shut-ins, keep to themselves, you know, had no real interactions with or apparent relationships with friends or neighbors, locked into their place of living all the time, possibly not even working. There is strong evidence, as we're hearing from you, and we'll continue to hear from our guests on the program that interpersonal connections really have a massive range of benefits. You touched on them a few moments ago, but let's get into that subject just a little bit more.
Well, you say something, you brought up something very important. It's people who feel that they don't belong, that they have not been successful with social relationships, that they may feel different from others. They may be experiencing this sense of stigma where even a sense of stigma from their own feelings about themselves of somehow being different. And this is a barrier. This is a true barrier to being able to connect with others, but there are things that individuals can do to help with that, as well as all of us as a community to reach out to those who are not able to get out, who have barriers of various kinds, such as disability or other factors that make them more isolated. And by even the effort to reach out to others has a benefit for the person who's reaching out as well, because you are making social connections.
There has been, a couple of studies to talk about. The first one directly related to that acts of kindness study, right?
Yes, and that was a small one. And the acts of kindness study showed that small acts of kindness that people did for their in a neighborhood that people did for their neighbors made a big difference in reducing loneliness of the people in the neighborhood, for the people doing the acts of kindness and the people receiving, reducing stress and reducing conflict with neighbors. And we see other examples of these kinds of efforts in the community. Just a few quick examples. There's something that I think is really cool, are the Happy to Chat benches in England, where they have these benches with signs that invite people to sit and talk with others. And this is also work to bring about a stronger sense of community. Another quick example are the chatter checkouts in a Dutch grocery chain, where it's like a slower line and people can get in this line and the cashier will, kind of stop and chat with you a little bit as they're checking you out. So these small acts in communities can make a big difference in connecting people. And even what we know is that social connection doesn't have to be, you have all these best friends. It can actually be a whole range of connections. Even those brief connections with the cashier, someone you say hi to and talk with briefly, maybe when you go to the gym, they all count. They all count in helping us to feel less stressed, more valued.
That's great. Well, for anyone who thinks this issue of social isolation and loneliness and the negative effects of it is some kind of recent, more kind of pop culture phenomena, I would just like to direct them to the year 1938, when Harvard began a study of adult development that involved the mental well-being among adults and began to look at loneliness and social isolation, including with a very particular subject near and dear to you, your dad, right?
Yes, this is such an important study. The most recent book about that, written by the current principal investigator, Dr. Wallinger, on this study called, it's by Robert Waldinger, MD, The Good Life, and he writes about, and it is a bestseller, as well as the other author is Mark Schultz, PhD. Mm-hmm. And this study began in 1938. They recruited Boston youth. My father was 12 at the time. And that there are about 456 Boston youth who were recruited, as well as another arm of the study had 268 Harvard College sophomores, including John F. Kennedy and Ben Bradley. So basically, they did incredible amount of very robust and comprehensive measurements on the participants in this study. This was all held in real time. It was not questionnaires asking, remember back to when you were a child. These were given while they were living the experience. They had physicals, they had IQ tests, they had psychosocial assessments. And all of this research occurred throughout these boys and then into men their entire lives. And there was a huge body of data that obviously was accumulated from all of this very hard work. And one of the major findings is that they found that satisfaction in the relationships of these men, where they felt connected, happy, and with friends, family, and community, that was the best predictor of a happy and healthy life. They were thinking, okay, nutrition, exercise, but actually it was the social connections, satisfaction in the relationships that was the best predictor for feeling happy. They're physically more healthy. They're less likely to get coronary artery disease or type 2 diabetes or arthritis. They actually also reported more success in their work as well.
That's fantastic. Folks, if you just joined us, this is segment one of three in our special report on loneliness and making connections. We're talking with Dr. Kathy Chapman, who is a therapist and a representative from the Connecticut Psychological Association. We have a lot more to talk about in the last 6 or 7 minutes that we have with you, Kathy. Let's move into the subject matter of loneliness and how it can be seen as a signal that guides us to social connection.
Yes, absolutely. It's important to keep in mind, as I mentioned before, we are social creatures. Humans are social by nature, and that feelings of loneliness are an important signal that is it's very personal. We can't really look around and see who's lonely and who's not, but it's our own personal signal giving us information that we are wanting or needing more connection in our lives, the more connections that matter to us. And I think sometimes that can be difficult for people to kind of recognize that is okay. It can sometimes feel like, well, what is wrong with me? I go to work, I talk to all these people, I still feel lonely. But actually that can be very, very normal, that you possibly might be having only one kind of connection, your people you work with, or maybe if you're spending a lot of time on social media, which can be a great way to connect with others, but it's only one way to connect. So that can be a sign that you need to vary the kinds of connections that you have and relationships that you have in your life.
Very good. One of the other things we wanted to talk about today is some of the specific challenges that are facing the very folks who've stepped up on behalf of all of us here in America, our veterans, and an event that's coming up shortly that involves something called Buddy Check, and it's actually got an entire week of education and advocacy. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. This is such an exciting program and so important. Veterans Buddy Check Week is asking any veteran to consider and possibly even make a commitment to try to connect up with some of their buddies that they have lost track with, maybe somebody they went to boot camp with, maybe somebody they served with at some point. And just to check up, even if it's a text or a quick phone call, that's even better. What we know is voice contact has a much more powerful sense of connecting with others than just texting. But the Veterans Buddy Check Week is an effort, however you do it, to connect with those people that you used to know, used to serve with, just to say hi and see how they're doing. They, if you go to the website, the VA website, you just type in Veterans Buddy Check Week, which is from October 21st to October 25th. It will give you lots of information on that, as well as there's a quick, I think it's about half hour training that you can take. It's a YouTube training from a veteran on just, you know, how to go about, you know, asking buddies about how they're doing and how to listen. So I would recommend that as well.
Excellent. In the last couple of minutes that we have with you, Kathy, can you take us through the checklist of ideas that might be able to help based on research if someone feels that they are not part of or are unwanted or do not want to be part of a social situation or enjoying greater social interactions in their lives?
Absolutely. And I just want to acknowledge that a lot of times we hear this message, well, just get out there and meet people. Well, that's not so easy, especially if you have been feeling lonely. Sometimes our thinking gets a little bit more narrow, and we can start to think that we're not going to be successful if we're making efforts. And that's okay. That's just all part of that feeling of loneliness. So it's not easy, but here are some ideas that research has shown that can be helpful. Beginning with starting where you are. What are your activities that you're already doing? What are you doing throughout your day? And recognizing that these are your interests, and possibly looking at small ways to expand that. Is your local library offering a talk on something that you're interested in? Are there others in your community? Sometimes one of the ways that going online can help is finding other people with the same interest. Another thing is to be aware of is the connections you already have, is actually focusing on those maybe a little bit more, making sure that with those connections you already have, that you're really present for them, that you're focusing on the person and possibly building on those connections, spending out a little bit more time. Sometimes we have to make that time in our routine. It's so easy. We hit the ground running in the morning, just trying to get through one thing after another. There's always a reason to stay busy. There's always something that needs to be done. So sometimes it has to be a conscious effort to go against the tide and actually make that time to a bit to that person who's been friendly, maybe ask them if they want to meet for dinner or lunch or just, you know, take a walk, mm-hmm. if that's something that's accessible for you. Or even having a small chat, maybe a little bit longer than how you usually talk to that person. There's a lot of research. PBS featured Dr. Noble talking about his work project on lonely. And he talks about beginning with creative expression, getting in touch with your own creativity. And that can look like anything, cooking, making something, dance, singing, whatever. And starting with those creative things as getting in touch with yourself and then reaching out to others.
All leading to the scientifically proven and lifestyle proven fact that small acts of connections count. We're going to wrap up this first segment here in our special report on loneliness and making connections. We want to extend our thanks to you, Kathy. Dr. Kathy Chapman is a therapist and a representative of the Connecticut Psychological Association, a fantastic resource for us here on the award-winning For the People. Next, we're going to hear about an organization who's already been on our program once before and that we talk about fairly often that is reaching out to a population of individuals who have a very, very challenging and difficult time in terms of acknowledging loneliness and other signs of concern. Those amongst our first responders and military heroes. We'll be back with that segment on this special report. And in the meantime, Kathy, thank you so much for your time this morning. Well, as I mentioned, going out of segment one, we are back with a organization and its founder, and we got to know Thin Line Peer Support Team a couple of years back, and we were able to have Liz Connolly with us on the program before talking about it at an earlier stage in its development. So much has happened with Thin Line Peer Support Team since our last conversation, and our reminders in the form of PSAs, hoping that individuals from telecommunicators to EMS, paramedics, firefighters, police officers, and military members know about this organization. These are individuals from those fields who are volunteering their time to provide peer support for fellow responders and others. Liz, thank you so much for joining us again this morning for our very special report on loneliness and making connections. This is something that is the really the driving force behind the Thin Line Peer Support Team, right?
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having us back on.
So for those who may not have heard your prior conversation with us or the PSAs that we've been trying to regularly air to connect this unique population of professionals and responders to you, tell us more about the inception and the journey that you've taken with Thin Line Peer Support Team since this all came together a few years ago.
So the Thin Line Peer Support Team, as you mentioned, is a volunteer organization. We are a nonprofit organization. We initially started with 12 volunteers. We started as the peer support team for Nelson and Access Ambulance, which is based out of North Haven, Stamford, Stratford, and Milford, as a commercial ambulance company for those towns. And we very quickly, within about the first week of starting as the peer support team for that company, we started getting calls from other organizations in the area, other fire department, other ambulance companies, asking from their employees if we were able to help them from their organizations and just from other employees who didn't want to use their own organization's peer support teams. For whatever reasons, whether it was personal, they weren't comfortable with the people on their teams, whatever their reasons were,
sure,
they reached out to us instead. And we, as we were talking to different people, we realized that the support just wasn't there. You know, there's a good number of clinicians out there who specialize in in mental health for first responders and military, but accessing those resources is not necessarily easy. Knowing who to reach out to, when you just do a quick Google search, you get a deluge of information and it just gives you a generalized list of providers. It doesn't tell you who out there is specialized in dealing with first responders and military. And when it comes to mental health, you're opening your heart and soul to these people. And first responders in the military, we're a very unique population when it comes to mental health in particular. We've seen a lot of trauma. We've seen a lot of things that will scare away the general population when it comes to talking about the things that we've seen, talking about the things that we've had to deal with in the course of our jobs. And you know, as somebody who's been in the field for almost 20 years now myself, I've gone through about 5 different clinicians myself in talking about the different things that I've seen with the different traumas that I've gone through the course of my job. And I've legitimately scared some of the clinicians that I've talked to when I've talked about some of the things that I've lived through.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, Liz, because I distinctly recall as I was, you know, in my capacity among the first responders to Sandy Hook, in the 24 to 48 hours after that incident, as Newtown was flooded with professionals who were rushing to the area to try to respond, not just to the immediate victims' families, but also to the responders who had to, kind of go through the door first or be part of that initial wave who was exposed to this tragedy, that it was the victims themselves and the responders who were upsetting the clinicians and the psychiatrists and psychologists and others. You really hit the nail on the head there when it comes to needing a highly specialized interaction for people in particular fields or professions to be able to, you know, kind of successfully work through things. And with that in mind, your team members are not just bringing life's experience and a good ear to the table on behalf of folks coming to you for support. They're actually certified and trained in this volunteer work they're doing.
Yes. All of my team members have been through a 27-hour training that certifies them all in peer support and critical incident group debriefings through the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation. So all of us have all been trained. We didn't just decide one day that we were going to do this and, you know, if somebody comes
jump
and talks
in the pool,
to us.
Yeah,
right. We're not jumping in blind and, you know, because there are a lot of things, you know, especially when it comes to the military, you know, if you say the wrong thing or if you, you know,
don't walk the
even
talk.
You know, or if you don't walk the talk or even if you react in a certain way, it can make a situation drastically worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are so many people that we've lost over the years that we didn't need to lose. That's why we've started this team. That's why there are so many clinicians now that are specializing in first responders and military. Mm. Because one life lost to the traumas that first responders see in the course of their jobs and the military sees in the course of their jobs is one life lost too many.
Yes, yes. Well, Liz, thank you for that insight. We're going to just give you a breather for a moment so we can take a moment to remind people that it's coming up. That I'm talking about the Women's Business Development Council and their 2024 Women Rising Gala. They will be recognizing these individuals at this annual gala and award celebration on October 25th for their commitment to the WBDC, demonstrated success in their businesses and the tenacity in pursuing their goals. The event begins at 11 a.m. at the Hyatt Regency down in Greenwich. And if you'd like to meet these entrepreneurs and community leaders and get all the details so you can be part of this event, just visit the Women's Business Development Council's website, ctwbdc.org. So we've got about three or four more minutes with Liz Connolly, who's a co-founder of the Thin Line Peer Support Team. If you'd like to learn more about them, they're very active on social, and they have a website, thinlinepeersupport.org. And in the last few minutes that we have with you, Liz, I was beside myself with excitement in hearing that you're getting calls not just for help and support here in Connecticut, but from agencies around the country who are looking to replicate the Thin Line Peer Support Team model. Let's hear a little bit about that.
Yes, we are rapidly expanding. Here in Connecticut, we've been contacted by the Connecticut Military Department, who is looking to start their own peer support network and have asked for our help in starting to develop their own peer support team which is phenomenal that they're looking to start that, because peer support, as it's been shown time and time again, is probably one of the strongest and best ways that we can support mental health for first responders in the military, because the people that have been there and done that are the people that can help pull others out of their ruts. Mm-hmm. And then we've gotten phone calls from a sheriff's county down in Georgia that didn't have access to any sort of peer support or mental health resources, that contacted us via Instagram and asked for our help until they could get training. So we're doing peer support via phone.
Like telehealth. For them. Yeah.
Yep, pretty much telehealth. While they get some of their officers trained. Mm-hmm. We've gotten phone calls from Florida, from officers who felt they had nowhere else to reach out to, and they had found our information through Reddit.
Wow.
We've joined the Peaceful Warrior Summit, which is a conglomerate of mental health resources from across New England, which their whole goal is to bring all of the mental health resources across across New England, essentially,
mm-hmm.
and pull them into one place to make them more accessible to everybody, and have everybody meet twice a year. So we'll be meeting up with everybody at the end of October in Northern Massachusetts. Essentially, it's for all first responders, all military, all veterans, and it brings together clinicians, peer support teams, any outdoor resources, so equine therapy, biking adventures, pretty much anything that can in any way, shape, or form be tied to mental health.
Fantastic.
And from Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Connecticut now.
Wonderful.
And we are working with, we have other members from other states who are now looking to join our team and hopefully start chapters in other states for us as well, so all we right. can start expanding our reach.
Very good. Well, as the name implies, Thin Line Peer Support Team's primary goal is a peer-to-peer resource for anyone who suffers a stressful or traumatic event. These events aren't limited to on-the-job incidents, and they differ from person to person based on their past experiences, as well as the time spent in the field. If you'd like to get in touch with this organization, if you're a responder that wants to be part of the team, or a responder who would like to talk to someone with empathy and understanding of your work outside your immediate agency, this is the organization to approach. ThinLinePeerSupport.org is their website. Also very active on social network, as you hear. Liz Connolly is among their founders. Liz, thank you so much for your time and your great work and continued success for your organization. We'll talk to you again. Before we get to our last segment with U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, we want to tell you about an opportunity for folks to become healthcare professionals and get some help doing it. Better wellness and improved patient outcomes start with a caring heart and the desire to make a difference. And the United Health Foundation's Diversity in Healthcare Scholarships are helping healthcare professionals from historically underrepresented backgrounds further their careers. RNs, mental health providers, pharmacists, the career paths are as diverse as America itself. So this organization is accepting applications now through October 31st at scholarshipamerica.org/United Health Foundation. We hope you can apply and become one of the new generation of healthcare professionals. Now, as we move into this final interview of our special report, before we turned on the mic, I found myself remembering my worst period of loneliness and isolation, which happened in 1979 when I moved away to go to college. And I shared that story with U.S. Senator Chris Murphy as we got into our conversation. Through all his work so far on this issue, Senator Murphy has emphasized the need to restore community at the local level to support social connection. And I was interested in hearing his thoughts about this issue in Connecticut and what progress he's seeing in developing communities in Connecticut and increasing social connection, especially among our young people who are facing such a crisis of loneliness and isolation since coming out of the COVID era. So I asked him about his feelings and what he thought about this issue.
Today, kids are spending, you know, somewhere between 40 and 60 minutes a day with friends. That's about one half to one third the time that they were spending with friends 20 years ago. In general, adults are spending half as much time in person with family and friends today than they were in 2000. And you see it because we have rising rates of self-harm, rising rates of addiction, rising rates of political instability as people are really dealing with the consequences of withdrawal. So I've really been digging into this problem. Some of the solutions have nothing to do with government, but some do. The reality is this social media is just been a poison for our kids. We've got to deal with the technology that addicts us away from being in companionship with others, instead putting us in companionship with our phone. And then we have to think about the places where we meet other people. They're weaker than they were 30 years ago. Churches are weaker. Labor unions are weaker. Social organizations, you know, with the bars in the basement that you used to meet friends, are weaker. And, you know, there's probably a role for government to play in trying to make some of those institutions healthier, the places where we historically have spent time with other people. We call them, in sort of social science, third places, right? You have home, you have work, and then you need third places where you find friends and companions. And we have a lot fewer of those today than we did decades ago.
Have you been heartened by learning of any organizations or projects in Connecticut that are specifically targeting restoring these communities and the opportunities to increase social connections?
Well, I really have been. I was just up in Enfield, Connecticut about a week ago, and Enfield's launched an entire new initiative to create more opportunities for people to find community. And they really tie it directly to mental health. They've realized that mental health can't just be medical treatment. It has to be trying to create more opportunities for people to find connection. And so they are in the process in Enfield of trying to figure out how to strengthen those organizations where people find each other. How do you give more opportunities for kids to meet other kids after school and on the weekends? How do you get seniors out of their home and into senior centers and other opportunities to meet other seniors? So I think this is going to happen on a community basis. I don't think there's going to be one big federal solution, but we certainly could try to find some resources at the state and federal level to help those communities. The governor has launched an effort to combat social isolation. I'm working with Republicans and Democrats in Washington. I think it'll be a locally led process, but we can support those local efforts with state and federal resources.
The other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit that may be contributing to the problem is this stigma against the admission of loneliness or social isolation because of the idea that it'll be viewed as a personal weakness. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, just like we've had a stigma, unfortunately, that's lessening around mental illness, diagnosable mental illness. We, you know, still have a stigma today around people admitting that they're feeling isolated, that they're feeling lonely. I really don't think that stigma should be as debilitating, because as you mentioned through telling your own story, every human being has an experience with loneliness. I mean, there's not anyone amongst us who hasn't had a moment in their life when they felt lonely. And so the minute that you reach out and talk to somebody about the fact that, you know, there are days where you feel really debilitated, you're going to find somebody who's had a common experience, you know, maybe not presently, but has had an experience like that in the past. We've got to help our pediatricians and our primary care providers be a little bit more adept at dealing with folks who report loneliness, because those folks don't always need a prescription, but they need some advice and maybe a referral to organizations in the community that can help them, get out of that cycle of withdrawal. So people shouldn't feel anything as reluctant to speak out, but we've also got to put professionals in a place to help folks who are making that admission.
I think I saw in one of the interviews I read leading up to our call that it's been pointed out that this is a common practice in some other countries, where people who are found to be either momentarily or chronically socially isolated are actually prescribed social opportunities.
Yeah, I wonder if we'll ever get to that point in the United States, right? We are definitely a little bit more of an individualistic society. But, you know, the problem is those places where you would go are just weaker than they used to be. And churches are an example. I mean, we've had a dramatic decline in the number of people who belong to a church. Now, some of that is just because, you know, churches have lost a little bit of the legitimacy that they might have had decades ago. But part of it is that they're just struggling to keep their doors open with high cost of living. And so as much as I'm a constitutionalist, I want a separation between church and state. I don't have any problem with trying to figure out some ways that the government could, you know, help keep religious institutions' doors open, because that is a place historically where a lot of people have found that community.
Yeah, certainly faith-based institutions have stepped up to the plate in myriad ways over history to respond to social and human service challenges.
Yeah, and we've been reluctant sometimes to have government to religious institution partnerships. I just think this is a moment where we can't be shy about trying to do that the right way. The other, you know, piece of this is that, you know, churches, those are the places where people not only found connection, but they found meaning, right? There was a story about, you know, how to live your life. People were taught and learned selflessness in those churches. And, you know, we are at the first moment in American history where less than 50% of the population reports that they have an affiliation with a religious institution. So that's meant not only that people have less opportunity to access community in those churches or synagogues or mosques, but also that they don't have the opportunity to, you know, kind of plug into a purpose that religious existence gives you. And, you know, that leaves people sort of grasping for purpose and meaning. I think it probably has to do with the fact that a lot of folks are trying to find that purpose and meaning in more dangerous, fringy places today than ever before.
Yeah. Well, I would call you a trendsetter in respect to the fact that you are way ahead of the ball in terms of recognizing the issue and acting to do something about it ahead of the Surgeon General's declaration about social isolation. You were busy in 2023, and if I have my timing correct, the first attempt to address this was the National Strategy for Social Connection Act, which was then followed up by the SILO Act, the Addressing Social Isolation and Loneliness in Older Adults. If you could, within the time that we have, just sort of flesh that out and let us know whether either or both of those are progressing as you did.
Yeah, thanks for highlighting them. Two different bills that I've introduced on this topic, and I've been working over the last few months to try to build Republican support for these bills. I think next year we'll be able to likely introduce some bills that have both Republican and Democratic support, so that's good news. The first bill you referenced is a bill that just sets up an office inside the White House that would really chart America's epidemic of loneliness and social isolation, would recommend best practices to states and municipalities that want to create more opportunities for connection, standardize the way that we study and report rates of loneliness so we really know whether they're going up or going down, and would pay attention to federal policies. So when we pass a law, we could have an office that would tell us, well, you know, actually, you know, on the face of it, that law looks like a good idea, but let me tell you how it's actually going to make people less likely to find the kind of community that makes people happy in the end. The second bill, the SILO Act, is an effort to do what I was talking about earlier, federal funds to support local efforts to get seniors out of their homes. Because sometimes you need dollars for the transportation to get seniors to the senior center. Sometimes you need dollars for the senior center to be able to run programming that attracts seniors to that center. So we would put in some real dollars dedicated to trying to reach isolated senior citizens. Let the decisions be made at the local level, but get them a little bit of federal help.
Great. Do you have a couple more minutes to talk a little bit about the Surgeon General's recommendations?
Yeah, I think it's really important because what the Surgeon General is saying is that there's real health consequences to loneliness. The Surgeon General's report, which was widely reported, showed that if you are lonely, if you're reporting feeling very lonely, you are at a much higher risk of heart disease. You're at a much earlier risk of dementia complications. And so even if you don't sort of believe my moral case that we should, you know, be addressing the loneliness problem in this country because of its sort of spiritual and metaphysical costs, it has, you know, old-fashioned physical costs. We're actually spending more money in this country on healthcare because we have, you know, too many senior citizens that, you know, don't have access to friends and relatives. What we know is that when seniors, at a moment when their health is declining, you know, can see a friend on a daily basis or see a relative on a daily basis, that actually keeps them healthier. We all know that from our personal experience, and you know, we should have some federal policy that helps address the health consequences of social withdrawal. Mm.
Certainly, our population of younger people is declining, and we certainly can't afford to lose even one of them to tragedy related to a feeling of social isolation or loneliness. You and Senator Blumenthal have been way out on the issue of reforming digital environments in line with one of the six recommendations by the Surgeon General. Can you let us know where those initiatives stand in terms of Senate action on the matter?
Yeah, I mean, this is really personal for me. I'm a parent of a 16-year-old and a 12-year-old, and I, you know, see through my kids and their friends how these algorithms that these social media companies have pumped it into our kids have just become a poison. I mean, I don't think those algorithms are any, you know, less harmful than nicotine. And you're seeing this very disturbing increase in self-harm rates amongst kids and reported intense loneliness amongst kids. And, you know, that's because they're sitting in front of these screens being addicted by an algorithm that really shouldn't be accessible to minors. So Senator Blumenthal has gotten a bill through the United States Senate that, you know, for the first time ever puts a legal duty of care on social media companies, which will make them think twice about addicting kids to content that is harmful. I have a different piece of legislation that would actually ban the use of the algorithm until you turn 18 years old. And, you know, there's bipartisan support for both of our bills. So I think in the next year or two, we'll be able to pass some pretty serious protections for our kids online, and we can maybe reverse this trend whereby kids are spending half as much time with friends on a daily basis as they were, you know, just a decade or two before the pandemic.
In closing, you potentially have tens of thousands of folks that may be listening to this interview in Connecticut, and certainly a proportion of them are probably experiencing some degree of social isolation or loneliness as they hear this. So in closing, speak directly to those people based on everything you've seen and learned and done, and let them know what your feelings are about their situation.
Yeah, listen, you're not alone, because there are so many other people who are feeling the same things that you are feeling. And, you know, there are a number of things that you can do. If you have a friend or a family member in your life, reach out to them. Tell them how you're feeling. I think you'll be surprised that, you know, you'll find a sympathetic voice on the other end of that phone call. You know, reach out to your healthcare provider, because there are physical consequences of loneliness. Our healthcare providers are getting to the point where they can be more impactful. And then, you know, maybe either individually on your own or through a friend, you know, look up online what some opportunities are to, you know, be able to find community in your community, you know, whether it's that senior center, whether it's a professional organization, whether it's a church. There are opportunities to be able to find people who care about the same things that you care about. There's a path out of that intense isolation that can happen for people, but it does always involve taking that first difficult step.
Yeah, I wish I had a resource that dark, cold night in October in 1979. But we are blessed with 988. I don't hesitate to ever remind listeners, you can text, you can chat, or you can call 988 if you're feeling so desperate, so alone that you're feeling maybe you don't want to be around anymore because nobody's ever going to want you. Here I am, you know, 50 some odd years later, having felt that same way. And Chris, I know you've heard those stories many times, and that's what inspires you. U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, working hard to mitigate social isolation and loneliness through his work. Very much appreciate your time this morning, Chris.
As always, John, thanks a lot.
Okay, take care.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Vocat. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger. for the ones who get it done.